Via remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden says he and President Donald Trump shouldn't have a debate if he still has the coronavirus. Biden said Tuesday that he is looking forward to being able to debate him, but said we're going to have to follow very strict guidelines. He says he doesn't know Trump's status since the president returned to the White House Monday after being hospitalized at the Walter Reed National Medical Center for 3 days after a COVID-19 diagnosis. Biden's campaign says he tested negative for the virus on Tuesday. President Trump, who is under doctor's care with the coronavirus, said on Tuesday that he is planning to show up for his second debate with the Democratic presidential nominee Biden next Thursday in Miami. Trump first tested positive for the coronavirus last Thursday and was hospitalized 3 days before returning to the White House. Based on that timeline, his attendance at a town hall-style event, during which he and Biden are to answer questions from members of the audience, could pose a public health risk based on guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC considers someone infected with the virus to be contagious from 10 to 20 days after the onset of symptoms. Meantime, Vice President Mike Pence, who has tested negative for the virus, is making campaign appearances this week. On Wednesday, he will face off against Senator Kamala Harris of California, the Democratic vice presidential nominee. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app via remote. This is VOA News. The Food and Drug Administration has laid out its safety standards for developers of COVID-19 vaccines after the White House blocked their formal release. The move Tuesday is the latest example of the tug of war between Trump officials and government scientists over the review and timeline for upcoming vaccines. Specifically, the FDA documents make clear that companies must provide at least 2 months of safety data from participants before being emergency approval from the agency. That requirement would almost certainly preclude the introduction of a vaccine by Election Day on November 3rd. Hurricane Delta, a Category 4 storm bearing down on Mexico. Residents and tourists in Cancun were evacuated Tuesday as Hurricane Delta strengthened with 145-mile-per-hour winds. Officials warning residents should have several days of water and food on hand. Tourists who stayed in hotels in Cancun, as well as some local residents, were evacuated to the Cancun Convention Center for shelter. Cancun had opened more shelters than usual to give people more space in recognition of the COVID-19 pandemic. Thousands of federal troops and emergency personnel are on standby to lend assistance if needed. Turkey's bid to become a member of the European Union appears to be in jeopardy after the bloc's executive branch Tuesday said it's displeased by what it called Ankara's failure to sustain democracy and fight corruption. In its annual report on the country, the European Commission cited more political power in the hands of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, which has resulted in a poor economy and eroded the independence of the judiciary. The report also said Turkish authorities continue to pressure civil society, aid groups, and the media. But Turkey, which began its EU membership talks in 2005, rejected the Commission's criticism, describing them as prejudiced, this according to the AP report. Well, experts from a global chemical watchdog group confirming Tuesday that the substance used to poison Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny was from the banned Soviet-style Novichok family of potent nerve agents. Novichok airlifted to Berlin for treatment after falling ill on a flight in Siberia back in August. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com, the VOA mobile app. By remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malians are jubilant over lifting of ECOWAS sanctions.
The vote is really positive because Mali and different countries of ECOWAS are really connected in terms of commerce and other exchange. So people are really happy.
A corruption inquiry in South Africa links a senior ANC official. Liberia's health minister appeals to striking health workers to end their strike. The stigma of mental health in Africa, and Tanzania's main opposition candidate accuses police of raiding party offices.
In the case of Arusha, they said they were looking for illegal immigrants. Looking for illegal immigrants in a Chadema office at the height of election campaign is just a stupid way of saying we have orders to disrupt you.
And heavy rains and COVID-19 pandemic exacerbate malaria conditions in Sahel countries. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There was jubilation Tuesday in Mali over the decision by the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, to lift sanctions on Mali. In a communique, ECOWAS said the military junta has met most, if not all, of the requirements stipulated by the regional group, including appointing a civilian transition leader and a prime minister, and the promise that the transition will last 18 months, starting from September 15. Moussa Kondo, country director of Accountability Lab Mali, says Malians are happy about the lifting of sanctions because the country's economy depends on regional trade. However, he says the new transitional government does not include technocrats and that it lacks female and youth representation.
The vote is really positive because people have a lot of business not happening. Because Mali and different countries of ECOWAS are really connected in terms of commerce and other exchange. So the sanctions banned and suspended all the transactions. I mean, from the road, the merchandising coming from Cote d'Ivoire, from Senegal. So people are really happy.
The sanctions were lifted because the transitional government has been put together. What do you know about who is in this government? Do you know if any members of the M5 protest movement in the government?
Yes, the new government came out with a couple of surprises. First of all, people expect a very technocrat government, which is not based on the different forces in Mali. When I say forces, it's like there was a sharing part of who is stronger to get what. So we have a lot of presence of militaries in the government in different ministries. Besides the security, defense, they are also in the administration of the territory. So knowing this is the ministry to organize the elections, so this is something people really not very happy. And also we've seen some former ministers come back to this government. M5 movement also is represented in the government in terms of the Minister of Employment, Mohamed Salia, who was the president of youth in the SEMAS, the movement of Imam Mahmoud Diko. So we see much more the government as a sharing part, more than a technocratic government who are nominated to solve problems. And also the lack of women on the 25 ministers, we have only 4 women. This also is the contrary of a specific law based on gender. So it did not respect that. And also the presence of youth in the government.
What can you tell us about the release of this opposition leader, Soumaila Cisse, and a French aid worker, Sophie Petronin? I mean, have people been able to see Mr. Cisse himself?
Yeah, we just got information. He got in the flight from Kidal to Gao. So this is something incredible news right now, as the country been waiting this for a long time. But when you see also the sacrifice or what happened, the negotiation in terms of what the government did, we realized like the government of Mali was doing everything to free Soumaila Cisse, to bring him back home. Because we heard about like hundreds of terrorists who have been arrested, and even some from other places which is not Mali, and also a huge amount of money to free Soumaila Cisse. So it is incredible news for all of us here in Mali. But when we take the sacrifice, what will be the impact of the security solving problems in the future? Because when we know like the armed groups, they make their living from paying ransom, paying money to free people. It will help them to also be to equip and buy arms and buy everything to put other people again in danger.
Moussa Kondo is the country director of Accountability Lab Mali. He was speaking with us from the Malian capital, Bamako. In Tanzania, the presidential candidate of main opposition Chadema Party says heavily armed police raided party offices in Arusha and Tarime and took away computers. Tundu Lissu also said police prevented him and other party officials early Tuesday from traveling to Kabaha district to open party offices. Lissu later said in a Twitter message that the police finally lifted what he called their illegal blockade after 9 hours, and that he was on his way to meet with his party supporters. Tanzanian police did not respond to our repeated request for comment. The Ethics Committee of Tanzania's Electoral Commission suspended Lissu last Friday for 7 days after he failed to respond to a summon to explain his claims that President John Magufuli and his ruling CCM party were planning to rig the October 28 election. Tundu Lissu said he was simply going to open party branches, not campaigning.
Last night, two officers in Arusha in northern Tanzania and one in Tarime in the northwest were raided by the police, wielding automatic rifles, anti-riot gear, and they beat up people. They broke the doors and windows, and they took away computers and other documents. These are offices which are used as the command centers during this period of election campaigns.
Did the police tell you why they raided the offices?
In the case of Arusha, they said they were looking for illegal immigrants. Looking for illegal immigrants in a Chadema office at the height of election campaign in one of the Chadema strongholds is just a stupid way of saying we have orders to disrupt you.
You say you've been informed that the regional and district police commanders have been ordered to raid your offices everywhere to destroy what can be destroyed and charge your candidates and party leaders and activists with non-billable offenses. These are very serious. Why would they want to do that?
The only way they can prevent us from winning the election is by making sure that we are not campaigning, by making sure that our candidates are under arrest, that you're not charged with these trumped up charges. So the only way Magufuli feels that he can defeat us in this election is by employing these dictatorial methods to try and derail our campaign. Already we have seen in a number of places in Njombe region in the Southern Highlands, 4 of our candidates have been arrested this past week, charged with murder in Tunduma on the border with Zambia in the southwest. 25 of our party members and several candidates have been arrested and charged with murder. And now we are told, as of last night, this is the way to go. They are going to try and destroy our campaign and our party organization between now and the general election at the end of the month.
You said you were going to open party branches and to speak to party workers outside Dar es Salaam. Do you think this was considered by the authorities as you campaigning?
I have no idea because I've not been served with a ban to begin with, but I understand there is a ban. We are not going to campaign. I'm just going to open party branches, and that is not prohibited by law. I'm going to be speaking to party workers. That is not prohibited by law. The suspension against campaigning is not a prison sentence. I'm a free citizen. I'm a party leader. I'm the national vice chairman of Chadema. The ban relates to political meetings, to campaign rallies. And what I had planned to do has nothing to do with political rallies. It had nothing to do with campaign rallies. But it seems like the Tanzania police force and the powers that be are interpreting the suspension as some kind of prison sentence, which I do not agree with entirely.
Tundu Lissu is the presidential candidate of Tanzania's main opposition Chadema Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dodoma. In South Africa, evidence at a commission of inquiry into corruption has linked to one of the ruling African National Congress's most senior officials to a project that resulted in the theft of hundreds of millions of rands. However, ANC Secretary General Ace Magashule has not been charged, leading to concern that President Cyril Ramaphosa's war on corruption will allow senior ruling party members to escape. But as Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg, prosecutors say it is not that simple.
7 years ago, Ace Magashule was premier of Free State Province, and his office gave the green light to two companies to remove asbestos from houses across the province. State prosecutors say the companies did work worth 20 million rand, but were paid 230 million rand, about $15 million. Many Free State residents still live in homes containing dangerous asbestos fibers. Seven serving and former government officials and businessmen have been arrested in the case on charges including fraud and money laundering. Magashule is not among them. Advocate Hermione Cronier is lead investigator for the National Prosecuting Authority, or NPA. She says bringing charges isn't always clear-cut.
Our job is to establish cases that we can take to court. So verify the evidence, make sure that it will be admissible in a court, and make sure that we put together indictments that we are confident will result in convictions.
Magashule says no evidence of graft will ever be found against him because he's never been corrupt. Still, some citizens have wondered why Magashule has not been charged in the case when those around him have been. Cronier, however, cannot speak about individual investigations.
I'm certainly not saying an individual is going to be on a charge sheet or not on a charge sheet. That will be determined by our ability to turn evidence into admissible evidence before a court.
Previous corruption cases linked to Magashule have collapsed because of poorly done investigations. Cronier and her team are treading carefully because they don't want this to happen again.
One of the big challenges that we have had is that there's a mountain of evidence. There are hundreds of people implicated. And so we are required to be fairly strategic about how we approach these prosecutions, how we sequence them, who is charged together with which group.
Because the Commission of Inquiry on Corruption said there's strong evidence that at least one corrupt payment from the asbestos project was channeled through Magashule's office. Cronier says that's not enough to charge him at this stage.
Charging someone is a very serious matter and has very serious consequences for that individual. So there is a threshold, and I can assure you when that threshold is reached, charges will follow.
Cronier acknowledges the NPA faces an immense task in trying to successfully prosecute powerful individuals.
We are also operating in a climate where the law enforcement has almost no credibility. So we have had to make sure when we put these indictments together that they signal to people that we mean business, that we are not just arresting for the sake of arresting. We're not arresting because we are being put under pressure to arrest. We're arresting because we've done the homework.
The advocate says so much corruption happened under former President Jacob Zuma that she and her investigators are buried in evidence. They've had to build the process and capability to properly investigate cases. Even so, some legal analysts say the NPA must prioritize some cases over others. So there's a good chance that many allegedly corrupt individuals will never be charged. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 7th. Shackling patients with mental health conditions is a sadly common practice in Africa, with some children as young as 10 being chained and worked in small spaces, according to a new report by Human Rights Watch. The tragic situation stems from widespread stigma about mental health and the lack of mental services in many countries. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to an activist and a survivor of the practice and brings us this report from Johannesburg.
For nearly a year, Benjamin Bilal was chained to a rock. This was no Greek myth. This, for him and for hundreds of thousands of people around the world, many of them in Africa, was real life.
2 years back, I was taken to a faith healing center by my grandmother and my mother. There I was shackled. I was chained to a log where I stayed for about 11 months. There was no food. They gave us food at will. When they feel like giving you food, they give you food. And there we had no freedom moving around. You want to move around, you move around with chains.
What did he do to get this treatment? According to doctors at Liberia's only mental health facility, where he was finally taken after 11 months of being shackled, he suffered from depression. The World Health Organization estimates that as many as 1 in 5 Liberians suffer a mild to moderate mental disorder. In 2016, according to WHO data, the West African country had only 1 registered psychiatrist. Additionally, poverty and lack of awareness usually put mental health low on the list of priorities for many struggling families. Although this is a prevalent practice in Africa, this is a global problem, says Kriti Sharma, a Human Rights Watch researcher on disability rights. She authored this year's report on this degrading practice and shared some of her experiences. We warn you, they are hard to hear.
Shackled people live in extremely unsanitary and degrading conditions. Many are forced to eat, sleep, urinate, defecate in a very small space, sometimes no larger than 1 to 2 meter radius. Simply put, dignity is being denied. One man in Kenya told me, I've been chained for 5 years. The chain is so heavy, it makes me sad. He stays in a room with 7 men. He's not allowed to wear clothes. He only wears an underwear, and he has to go to the toilet in a bucket. He told me, it's not how a human being is supposed to be. A human being should be free.
Sharma said this happens because many governments do not provide adequate support and services for people with mental health issues. Michael Njenga, Kenya-based chairman of the Pan-African Network for People with Psychosocial Disabilities, says he has 2 recommendations for governments.
We need absolute prohibition in terms of shackling. I think that for me is very, very important that we need to have the enabling legal frameworks to address all the challenges. But we need to go beyond legal frameworks and look at what are the systematic things do we need to address. And I think for me, most importantly, is that looking at the intersection between availability of mental health services within the community, it is important to ensure that we develop a wide range of community-based mental health services that respond to the needs of persons with psychosocial disabilities.
And says Sharma, the report's author, the global pandemic has made the problem even more dire.
People go in and out of chains depending on the support that's available in the community. I've personally documented a case who was shackled for 8 years in a shed. He was freed. He went back to the community because he had access to support. He had a job. He, you know, did the local call to prayer in his mosque. And then 4 years later, when COVID-19 hit, he was shackled once again by his family because there was a disruption in government services.
Benjamin Bilal's story, however, has a better ending. After his older brother fished him out of the Faith Healing Center and took him to a mental health facility in Monrovia, he was able to complete his education. He's now a school teacher and a mental health activist, working with governments to make sure what happened to him never happens to anyone else. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Liberia's Minister of Health, Wilhelmine Ajala, says the government has no intention to fire striking healthcare workers. Instead, Ajala says the government is encouraging the workers to return to work while it looks into their demands. The nurses have been on strike for nearly a month to demand payment of their salaries and hazard benefits. Last month, President George Weah ordered the Ministry of Health to consider replacing the striking healthcare workers with qualified health professionals. But the National Health Workers Union of Liberia said the president's ultimatum was synonymous with threatening the entire national health-related workforce, including doctors. Minister Jala says the government is working hard to meet the workers' demand.
The government is still negotiating with the healthcare workers. We have had many conversations with them, and we hope that they will go back to work while the government look into the different issues. Many of the issues are regular healthcare issues, the things that they are asking for, the things that should be provided in terms of wages, in terms of making sure that things that we need to work in the facilities are there. And we have been making progress on those things. I myself, as a healthcare worker, I know wages have been low in the health sector, but the government is looking into increasing those wages as time goes by. It has to be a stepwise process. Things have to happen in order for changes to come. Striking is not the best way to go, so we encourage people to go back to work as we look through the different issues to try to settle it in the benefit of our valued healthcare workers.
I read in one of the local newspapers this morning, Minister, that the government is contemplating firing the nurses if they did not return to work. Is this true?
It is not true. We are not firing anybody. We are encouraging people to go back to work. This is where, from the time of this strike, every time we speak, we are encouraging you to go back to work. No system can function if the people that are supposed to be doing the work are not there. So that's why we're encouraging people to go back to work, because we are taking care of the Liberian people. We need to be there as we do our part to make sure what you need to work with are there.
Health institutions in Liberia are already not operating that well. If that is the case, who has been working for these nurses since they've been on strike?
There are volunteer nurses. In any system, you have people who have graduated a long time ago, but they do not have a job. They come to an institution and say, we want to volunteer to keep our skills up. So they go into the institution and they work alongside of the people that are assigned there to work. So since the people who were assigned to work are not there, and these people were already working along with them, most of them have been helping in terms of seeing the patients and taking care of the patients. They have been doing it all along, so now they are just stepping up to the plate to do it.
Wilhelmina Jala is Liberia's Minister of Health. She was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. Heavy rains and COVID-19 pandemic have exacerbated malaria conditions in many Sahel countries this year, especially in Niger. Philippe Livaland, who works with Doctors Without Borders in Niger, tells Ricky Schreier that there are low stocks of anti-malaria drugs, both because of pandemic-related factory closures in Asia and miscalculated estimates based on last year's figures.
This year is very specific, first because of the COVID. So this means, as a consequence, some problems in the factories in India and China. Some of them, especially in India, have been closed because of the COVID. So there is a low level of production of anti-malarial drugs, lower than previous years. Then there are some problems of transportation. So this means that we have two things in the same time, lower production and increase of the people in need.
What kind of increase have you seen numbers-wise as far as malaria cases?
Yeah, it's mainly about malaria cases, but because, you know, you cannot foresee every year when malaria is coming. So it's sooner than last year, for instance. And because of the flooding, we have more cases first. And then because we are more specifically taking in charge young children, because of the COVID, let's say there is some prevention done to children that we call SMC, so seasonal malaria chemo prevention, that consists in 4 rounds of anti-malarial drugs in order to prevent children to catch malaria. COVID has created some disorganization within health structures and the way to administer the prevention, because it has been asked to the health workers to keep some distance with the patients. Mm-hmm. So if you add the rain and prevention not as good as the previous years, and some tension on the provider and the supply of the anti-malarial drugs, we have a dramatic situation.
That was Philippe Livaland, head of mission in Niger for Doctors Without Borders. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar. And that's it for this Wednesday, October 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a good day.